Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the new chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors on keeping more county residents in their homes.
And the disappearance of a beloved Peoria waiter sparks an outpouring of love and concern.
But first, Governor Katie Hobbs on Friday released her budget proposal for the fiscal year that starts on July 1st. The plan calls for raising new revenue, including from the federal government, and focuses on the governor's call for affordability measures. But perhaps not surprisingly, GOP leaders in the state legislature are criticizing the plan. With me now for our weekly look at what to expect in the coming days at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. The question is, why are we letting people who went into journalism, because of the fact we're all math impaired, handle budget questions?
well, we'll talk maybe broadly in numbers here. So, Howie, one of the things that has been written quite a bit about this budget is new sources of revenue. I mentioned the governor looking for money from the federal government. She's also looking for some money on the state level.
Exactly. And that's been part of the question in terms of, is this a truly balanced budget? You start off, as you point out, with a $760 million. This is the money the state billed the federal government for. There's a provision in H.R. 1 that said we're going to make something like $13.5 billion available to states for their costs of protecting the border while Joe Biden was president. And the governor had put together some numbers supported by the Republican legislation, came up to about $760 million. Now, building the budget on that, that's an interesting question, because remember that the state of Texas alone says they're due for $11 billion. Mm. And, you know, once Texas is done, you know, I guess maybe we're scraping for the crumbs. There's obviously a lot of other stuff in there, the $3.50 fee on vacation rentals, raising the tax on what large online gaming places have to pay the state, elimination of a $38.5 million tax break for data centers, a 1 cent fee on water used by data centers, and then capping vouchers, which theoretically isn't a money issue, but if you limit who can get vouchers based on family income, that brings in another $83 million. Now, that's all contingent on the legislature going along, with the exception of the federal money, which may or may not be coming.
Yeah, well, and we've seen that the Speaker of the House, Steve Montenegro, referred to this budget as a, I'm going to quote him here, a fantasy built on fake revenues and hidden tax hikes. Not exactly a ringing endorsement.
No, not exactly. And again, it's not surprising, but also remember that the tax cuts that the Republican majority wants to give are larger than what the governor is giving out. I mean, by a major margin. We're talking about $440 million in tax cuts based on the GOP plan versus $250 million, depending on what you include in the governor's plan. So none of this stuff balances out, because even the Republicans, I think, are counting on some things that may not happen.
So, Howie, when you talk about some of the spending measures that are in this budget, the governor's talked a lot about affordability, as a lot of Democrats and some Republicans have as well. What are some of the highlights of what she would like to spend some of that newfound revenue on, assuming she can get it?
Well, she wants to expand eligibility for the school lunch program, also the summer lunch program for kids during vacation, weatherization projects, gets some money to leverage for new home construction and multifamily construction by using some state and some COVID money, and then trying to cut down on and maybe eliminate the wait list for subsidized childcare for families, because if you can't get childcare, then you stay home, which may make you eligible for other state services. So it's all designed to fit into that.
Howie, let me ask you about, you referenced the tax bill that the governor vetoed, and the difference in how much conformity Republicans want with the federal law versus what the governor wants. Now that that is vetoed, what is likely to happen next? Understanding there's a deadline, people have to file their taxes in April.
Well, you're making the assumption we'll have a deal by April. I have a feeling a lot of us are going to be filing for extensions or filing and then having to file amended returns, which is the fear of people like J.D. Mesnard, who heads the Senate Finance Committee, said, look, we need to get something done. It's complicated by the fact that what the Department of Revenue put out as forms that you can actually find online now does not conform with either the bill the Democrats have introduced or what the Republicans have done. So you'll file at your own risk. I think that the biggest part of that bill is there's a common belief that we should raise the standard deduction. 88% of Arizonans take the standard deduction because of the fact that it's so generous. Unless you happen to have a very large mortgage with interest or a large car loan with interest, there's no reason to do that. I think that the governor and the legislature agree there should be no tax on tips or no tax on overtime, although I have to admit that a lot of Democrats say, why aren't we taxing tips? If a bartender is making $30,000 a year and an office worker is making $30,000 a year and the bartender's salary includes tips, why are we paying different tax rates? You do have some areas of disagreement. For example, the governor's plan would give a $6,000 deduction, additional deduction to seniors. The Republican plan would make that deduction, but only for withdrawals from retirement accounts and 401ks, meaning if you happen to be a senior but don't have a 401k or retirement account, you don't get the break. Mm. And then, of course, you've got the Republicans substituting out child care credits versus the car loan interest bill that was in the governor's original plan. So lots of little details to work out. Can people file? Yeah. But be aware, you may have to file an amended return, or again, you can just file an extension. But be aware also, when you file that extension on April 15th, you have to pay any taxes owed. Now, majority of people are due for refunds, but you got to be very careful there.
Right. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Lots to look for going forward. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
In Prescott, the city council has been debating the latest version of the city's general plan. Controversy has erupted over a draft of the plan, which would include non-binding language expressing the city's commitment to DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Conservative critics say DEI language is ideological and potentially harmful. They argue that it's outside the scope of a document which should focus narrowly on issues like land use, transportation, and water. But at a recent council meeting, a Prescott resident named Isaac Jackson stepped to the podium. Jackson grew up in Prescott. He's a student at Yavapai College and works part-time as a delivery driver at a pizza restaurant. He says his experience on the job is evidence in favor of including DEI measures in the general plan. I spoke to Jackson last week, and I began by asking him to share some of those experiences.
So I had an order that was in this gated community, and the customer, of course, provided me the code to get in and everything. But then as I parked in front of his house, I saw this woman walking up to me. I mean, she looked like she was in her later 30s, maybe early 40s, and she was walking her dog, and she came up to my window, and she just said, "Are you lost? You look like you're lost." So I replied, "No, ma'am, I'm not lost. I'm in the right spot. I'm a delivery driver." And she responded with that, "Okay, well, you look like you don't belong here." And there is a certain tone that people of color can, how do I put this? You could tell when there's a little bit of an underlying, I think you know what I mean.
Sure, I'm following you. I'm following you.
Yeah, yeah. And so then after that, I was just kind of in shock that she had said that. And then she said, "Don't park in front of my house or near my house." And then she just walked away. And I wasn't doing anything. I was doing my job.
Yeah. And just to make sure I am following you, you interpreted her saying you look like you don't belong here as a reference to the fact that you are a person of color.
Yes, I definitely interpreted that as racially motivated.
So that was one experience that you
yes.
shared. And then there was another one.
Yeah. So the second one was it was another delivery not too much long after that one, by the way. I was delivering to this church. And when I got there, in front of the church, there was an elderly gentleman wearing a leather jacket. He was sitting on a Harley. He was smoking a cigarette. And I didn't really know where I was supposed to go. So I just asked him, "Excuse me, would you happen to know where I could find Tim?" I'm just going to use Tim as the placeholder name here because,
sure.
Honestly, I don't remember the name.
That's fine.
And Yeah, and the man didn't respond to me. He didn't even look at me. He just puffed his cigarette again. And then I saw the church doors open, and five or six men, they all came out. And the last one that came out was a muscular man. He was wearing a ribbed tank top. And I noticed a swastika tattoo on his upper chest. And he came up to me and he just asked, "Is this for Tim?" And I nodded, yeah. And so he said he was going to go get him. And then Tim came out, and he also had a swastika tattoo. It was just a little bit smaller. And he said, "Yeah, man, the pizza's 30 minutes late. I'm not paying for that. What are we going to do about this?" And again, going back to the first story, there's a certain tone that you can just sense when people ask you questions or when people say anything to you. And it's like, it's so recognizable. And after he said that...
Well, sure. And that's the case even when there's no swastikas present. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. We're pretending that the swastikas weren't even there for a second, right?
Right.
That's something I don't think I need to touch on. But
no, they sort of speak for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And so they all just stared at me, waiting for me to respond. And that was, I'm not gonna lie, that was kind of scary. So I just said, yeah, we'll take care of it. And I gave him his pizza, and then they all went inside. And first of all, I wasn't late. Second of all, if I had not have given him his food, I really don't know what would have happened from there. I mean, it was a little threatening, I'm not going to lie. I was pretty scared.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't blame you. And one of the other things that you shared in your speech is that you have lived in Prescott, I think you said, for something like 14 years. Prescott, as you say, is your home.
Yes, it is. I believe I was 6 years old when I moved here. And so... the majority of my childhood memories are from Prescott.
How would you characterize these experiences that you shared about in your speech in the broader context of your life there as a person of color?
The best way to put it is, as I got older, the experiences became a lot more prevalent, especially in high school. I mean, I went to Trinity Christian School, which is a private school here, and I was only there from fourth grade to my freshman year. But I started to notice some of these encounters. They started showing up more around that time. I mean, when I was at Trinity, this was in sixth grade, I have a core memory of I was at the time, one of my friend's house. I'm not going to say his name, but we were watching a boxing match, and the result of the boxing match was not in my favor. And I got up and I was like, oh, like I was visibly upset. Mm-hmm. And he just said, "Shut up, N-word," and him and his whole family started laughing. And I'm not going to lie to you. At the time, I started laughing too, because I was in sixth grade and I was super impressionable and I was around a bunch of my white friends and his family. Mm-hmm. And so I really had no idea. Like, it didn't even occur to me that, like, that is a problem. And then until I started getting older and started to realize, like, wow, this is a problem. I don't know why it's difficult for people to realize that, like, this is a problem and we should be doing more about this. Something I've noticed is, because of the lack of care in these areas, people my age and of similar background to me just feel hopeless, man. The amount of conversations I have about the dreams and the goals that, like, the visions that we have for this town, because again, it's beautiful here, but...
Well, I'm really glad you're bringing this up, Isaac, because this was going to be my next question for you. In your speech, I think you said, you know, something to the effect of, God has blessed Prescott with all of this beauty. It's clear that you're not coming at this from a place of hating Prescott.
From the complete opposite, man. Oh, my goodness.
But I appreciate you describing how these incidents made you feel, because you gave your speech in the broader context of this ongoing debate that is happening on the Prescott City Council about whether to include DEI language in the 2026 general plan. And you said, quote, "DEI is not about unfair advantages for people who look like me. It is about basic fairness and dignity." Can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean when you say it's about basic fairness and dignity, especially in relationship to these incidents that you've been describing?
I think it would just make people like me understand that, like, we are seen, and our, like, the problems that we encounter to a day-to-day basis, like, mm-hmm. it is something that the city council is thinking about, and it's something that they do care about. And it's just really concerning to me that, like, this is even a conversation.
For you, you're saying this is about the town kind of declaring a mindset that is aware of the types of incidents that you and it sounds like other people you have spoken to have had to deal with.
Absolutely. Why is it a common theme of, like, people coming here and having bad experiences? I mean, just today, literally just today, as I was coming home, I parked and I saw that there was a family looking around my complex. And when I got out, one of the gentlemen asked me, hey, friend, we're thinking about moving here. What's your experiences here in this apartment complex? And I asked him, what's your concern? And his only answer was racism. Like, that's your concern about, like, moving into this apartment complex. So what that tells me is that that is a thought that's on a lot of people's minds when they're moving here.
Well, I have been speaking with Isaac Jackson, who is a Prescott resident. Isaac, thank you for doing this, and thank you for sharing your stories.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, hundreds of people took to Facebook to rally support and appreciation for their favorite server at a Denny's in Peoria, who they haven't been able to contact since he left the job. We'll hear from one of them about why this waiter made such an impact.
But first, with the new year, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors has a new chair. Kate Brophy McGee takes over the position. She was elected to the board in 2024 after serving in the state legislature and in other elected offices. In moving into the role, she's laid out a number of issues she'd like to tackle this year, mainly focusing on quality of life. And when I spoke with her earlier, we started there.
Well, I will tell you that I do have chair priorities, but my basic priority as the leader of the board is to get the basics right. So making sure that what is working stays working and that we continue on the path that former Chair Galvin set for us as a brand new board. And that we focus on public safety, and in my case, I really focus on quality of life for Maricopa County constituents. That, in turn, leads to the type of economic development and job creation we can all get behind.
I know that one of those quality of life issues that you want to tackle or at least look into is evictions. And there have been a lot of Maricopa County residents evicted from their homes over the last number of months and years. What can the county try to do about that? Like, what solutions are potentially available to you?
So I was approached by leaders on the City of Phoenix Council who are working to tackle this issue. And when I started looking up the statistics, I was pretty shocked. There are more than 80,000 eviction filings for the third year in a row. So I started looking towards what's out there now that is working or working on this issue, because it's pretty shocking. I then talked to some of the individuals and agencies involved, such as the justice courts and the multi-housing folks, to come up with a set of principles around which we might solve part of a problem. The Maricopa counties, like all the counties, is a statutory subdivision or administrative arm of the state. So working within existing state laws, what can we do? I also understand from my work down at the Capitol that homelessness is a spectrum issue. And you might say, well, what do you mean by that? That there are individuals and families on the cusp of eviction that want to stay housed. And that's the group that I am focused on. You go all the way to the other end of the spectrum and you're dealing with the people who are typically severely mentally ill and or addicted. So this is intended to tackle those folks who want to stay in their homes. Confirming with the multi-housing agencies, The landlords don't want to kick people out. It costs them time. It costs them money. It costs them lost rent. So what could we do? What part could we play in reducing that rate of $80,000 a year, keeping families in their homes, and on the economic side, keeping making sure landlords continue to collect their rents?
So you mentioned, you know, doing what you can within existing state law on evictions.
Yes.
I wonder if there might be changes to state law that you think might make it a little easier to achieve what it is you're trying to achieve.
It could well be, but as I did so often in the legislature, I would start with what is, not what I want it to be. And so any results that we achieved would be incremental, but they would be in the realm of really possible. So what I was shocked to learn in my deep dive this past year, most people know that they will miss their rent payment before they miss it. Once the rent goes 5 days past due, that throws the entire problem or issue into an eviction cycle in which most of those folks do wind up being evicted. So I'm looking at the 5 days before the rent is due and the 5 days after the rent is due, and working from the confirmed premise that landlords really do not want to evict because of the costs and the lost rent.
So you reference, you know, your time in the state legislature. I'm wondering how that maybe informs how you approach both this job as chair of the Board of Supervisors, but also the kinds of issues that you're looking to delve into this year, given your experience on the state level and now the county level.
Well, and thank you. As I told you earlier, work with what's possible as opposed to what you want it to be. That way you can scale your expectations back and not just be hideously disappointed. So that's been a huge part of it. I always have gravitated to quality of life issues, child welfare, homelessness, mental illness. And so I'm comfortable in that wheelhouse. And once I got into the job as county supervisor, I discovered that there is work we can do there. And wonderful people like Presiding Judge Pamela Gates, who will work with me.
Let me ask you about one other issue that you are sort of inheriting from last year, which is that of elections. Obviously, 2026 is an election year. The county has a number of elections it'll be running. Do you have a sense of when we're expecting to see the results of the audit, the look through that you guys authorized last year?
The results of the chain of custody audit and the technology audit are, my understanding is they're finishing up their report and we will be presenting it to the public shortly. I am committed, along with my colleagues, to doing everything we can to make our voters feel confident in elections outcomes.
How confident are you in the way that the county is running its elections? Obviously not having seen the results of this quite yet, but I'm curious, just based on what you know and what you've seen, how confident are you?
I am very confident, and I have said that publicly. I've experienced elections up close and personal since actually 2000, you know, school board, legislative. And this last election was my 17th campaign. It resulted in a recount because the margins were very close. I observed as a candidate from that side of it. And of course, once I got over onto the county side of it, I observed as an election administrator. You know, elections are run by human beings. And seeing the dedication of those employees to getting it right means the world to me.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Kate Brophy McGee, the new chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. Thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. It's been an honor to talk to you.
Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Our next guests this morning are married both in their personal lives and their professional ones. Gary Ferguson is a best-selling author who was recently on the show talking about his latest book documenting the decline of Arizona's ponderosa pine forests. Mary M. Clare is a social scientist whose work focuses on the psychology of communities.
And together, they have founded Full Ecology, which is a lot of things that we'll let them describe for you. But it involves a book, lectures, a TED Talk, retreats, and more. And the idea is to help us all ground ourselves in a climate change world. We cannot heal the planet, they say, without first healing ourselves. Our co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with them recently in our studios to talk more about it.
I want to begin with, I guess, what brought you to this, right? Because you're both coming from kind of different but colliding perspectives. Gary, you're an author. You've written a lot of books about nature. Mary, you are a social scientist. I mean, when you two met, were these ideas something that came up right away?
Funny you should ask. Yeah. As soon as we met, some almost 13 years ago, we got together, and I happened to be at the time involved in the Wolf Project in Yellowstone, writing about the reintroduction after that animal had been gone for so many decades. You know, everything I would say, Mary would have a companion idea or piece about social ecology. And we came to begin to really, really appreciate that since we are nature as humans, we are hardwired with some of the same superpowers that all the rest of nature has.
So in that particular moment, Gary spoke about the phenomena around the return of the wolf and how important community is to wolves, that there's really no such thing as a lone wolf, as it turns out, or very little evidence of that. So I said, wow, you know, when people have experienced trauma, the best predictor of they're doing okay is having community. And now we know that when people are moving forward in age and showing signs of what we call dementia, whatever it might be, that that is mitigated by being in community. So it's no surprise that the indigenous people of many tribes in this country gained guidance from watching the wolves.
So you can see right there how your work started to collide from the very beginning. So let's talk about Full Ecology, what this means, what it is. I mean, you said that just then, Gary, that humans as nature phrase, which is kind of key to all of this. What does that mean?
Well, really, Full Ecology is about, I think, trying to break down the walls that we have built, especially over the last 300 or 400 years, between ourselves and the natural world. We have made ourselves separate from, and in all reality, life does not just survive, but it thrives by virtue of its interconnectedness. So to bring humans back into the definition of nature offers lots of kinship with the natural world, but it also opens us up to having the opportunity to see, okay, how does nature really handle these particular problems? Of course, we have our own expression as humans of solving those problems, but we can learn a lot from nature as far as how these qualities play out in our own lives.
So it's lessons learned, but you're not talking about physically breaking down the walls of our houses and all living outside in nature?
Well, no.
Or maybe.
But we do ask the question often in our talks. In the next week, see, I'm a recovering professor, so I give assignments. In the next week, check and see if you end where your skin ends. Just check and see. So no, we're not saying we're going to just go out and live from the land, although some people are making that kind of choice. We're saying you are nature, in nature. You have always been nature, but don't believe us. Check it out. This has been super comforting for many, many people in this time.
Yeah.
We realized that if we want to take care of our ecology as we think of it outside of us, which we would argue it is not, we say you must attend to your internal ecologies, your social ecologies, the ones between you and within you.
Right. So you mentioned something there I want to ask about, because you talked about how people find this comforting. And I know you travel the country, you talk to people, you hold retreats, right? Like, I wonder, especially in this time, and you address this on your actual website, like, this is a time that is divisive and frustrating and, you know, feels difficult, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of people have this kind of urge to withdraw, to just give up, or a lot of people are angry about what's happening in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And you're sort of saying this is not disconnected from yourself.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it would be unusual and unhealthy to not be going through some grief mm-hmm. over all that's happening. But the solution is not to withdraw from it, but really to walk into the grief, because that's how you'll ultimately end up on the other side. The second thing that I think we would both say is this is not something to consider as you, again, as a separate being all by yourself having to deal with.
Yeah.
As Bill McKibben often says when he's asked, what can I do as an individual, you know, to make any difference? I'm just this lone person. Mm-hmm. Well, he says, stop acting like a lone individual. Come together. This is a set of problems and an opportunity for us to learn to find those people who we are in kinship and community with and act from that social group. And that's a big, powerful move.
That's powerful, but it's also incredibly difficult right now, right? Like, so much of what's happening in our society, in our culture, in our country is mistrust of institutions and isolation, technology sort of getting in the way of lots of kind of human-to-human relationships. Is this, you think, a more important moment to talk about these things or a more difficult one?
The thing that we're seeing is that climate activists have been drawn to giving you lists of 10 things you can do.
Yeah.
Recycle, la, la, la. And what the first thing that really needs to happen, we have these four orientations in Full Ecology. And the first one is that you've got to stop, which is so paradoxical. But just stop. Stop all the thoughts. Stop all the noise. Stop. Even if for just a split second. And then watch how you have this tendency when you see something as problem to jump and solve it. And we know from social science data now that when you do that, without slowing down to ask and to explore what the problem is from a stopped place, you're answering the wrong question 95% of the time.
What do you mean? What question should we be answering?
Well, instead of there's a problem, I've got to do something.
Yeah.
The stopping is centering, quieting. Sounds so potentially woo-woo, but watch a tree. Watch a squirrel. So stopping and then getting information about what's really going on, receiving information about what's really going on, and the action follows from that.
And I would say, too, that when people stop and look, as far as what Mary was saying, what's going on, look around your own neighborhood. What's going on in your neighborhood, in the city, and what calls to you as something that you think you would like to apply yourself to? Is it gonna fix the world? Maybe one day long after you're gone, but right now it's an opportunity to make social connections with other people who are also concerned, and it's an opportunity to align your life with something that means so much to you. You know, I mentioned grief earlier. We wouldn't grieve if we didn't care so much about what was being lost.
Yeah.
Mary made that mention earlier, do you really end at the edge of your skin? You know, consider when you're out, if you walk under a tree, that tree's not just giving you oxygen, but phytoncides, which you breathe in and actually strengthen your immune system and your vital organs. Your hormone levels, some of them are being set by your interaction with daylight. There are more microbes living in your body than human cells that did not exist when you were first born that came to live with you. And that's what allows you to break down food and get the nutrition. So this isn't a trick question. It really is pointing toward a massive truth that we are not here just by ourselves. We're here in a community with the natural world and hopefully more and more with a community of humans as well.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Gary Ferguson, Mary M. Claire joining us, the co-founders of Full Ecology. Gary, Mary, thank you both so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's a delight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
European Union officials say they have, quote, tools at their disposal to respond if President Trump follows through on his threat to impose new tariffs on several European countries over their objection to his plan to take over Greenland. The fate of the island is among the key global stories in the coming days. With me for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, what can we expect this week on the Greenland front?
Yes, so a lot happening on Greenland, as your listeners will know, I'm sure. Last night we had eight European countries threatening, who are threatened with tariffs by President Trump because of their opposition to him taking over Greenland as an island. Well, all of them, all eight of those European countries issued a statement saying the move would undermine transatlantic relations and risk a dangerous downward spiral. And they stress the importance of sovereignty, you know, territorial integrity, because, of course, Greenland is a semi-autonomous part of Denmark, an EU member and a NATO member and so on. So a lot of this we know, and it's worth pointing out, of course, Mr. Trump's position, which is that, of course, what he regards Greenland as being vital for U.S. national security reasons. And as you know, he's not ruled out using military force to acquire it. But clearly, at a time, of course, when NATO is doing its utmost to be seen to be sticking together over the war in Ukraine, here it is in a very volatile position with very public arguments now between Europe and the U.S. over Greenland. And in fact, just looking at our newsroom, in the last hour or so, President Trump has linked his push to take control of Greenland to his failure to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Apparently, he's told Norway's prime minister that he no longer feels obliged to think, quote, purely of peace. He made the comment in response to a text from the Norwegian prime minister and Finland's president urging him to de-escalate the dispute. So there's no sign of this de-escalating at the moment, and that's going to be make it even more of a kind of front page story this week, because Mr. Trump is expected to be in Davos in Switzerland for the World Economic Forum, giving a speech on Wednesday. So he's very much going to be sort of hobnobbing with European and other NATO leaders in the coming days. So I think Greenland's going to be absolutely front and center of the news once again this coming week.
Yeah. So, Rob, let's go now from Greenland to India, which is gearing up for a census coming up, one of the world's largest administrative exercises. What's going on with this?
Yeah, so quite a different story, this. But your listeners, if they'd been asked a couple of years ago which is the most populous country in the world, they might well have said China. I think most people would have done. But actually, China was overtaken by India. And India is now the highest population in the world, with about 1.45 billion people. Now, what they're going to do, India, is they normally do a census about once every 10 years. But because of the pandemic, because of COVID-19, that was postponed. And so there's been no census in India for about 16 years. So what they're doing now is they're in the process of recruiting 3.5 million people. And this is a quote from the Economist, actually. But it says these people will, quote, venture into deserts, trek into jungles, and climb soaring mountains to reach remote villages, the mountains being the Himalayas in that case. So you're going to have literally millions of people fanning out over India in the coming months, trying to count dwellings, trying to count people, trying to get a much better sense of the current sort of demographic in India. And this is important for things like policy making. So if people know what the population is and where they are and what kind of infrastructure they need, what sort of welfare services, essential services they require, well, of course, that totally affects both national and state and local politics. So it is actually very consequential. The other thing is that since independence from Britain in 1947, India has never counted, believe it or not, it's never counted its caste system people. In other words, it doesn't know how many people are in each of the different castes in India, which is still a major thing in Indian sort of cultural life. So this is going to be really interesting to see the demographics of India and also the kind of caste makeup of India. It will be a sort of modern snapshot, if you like, of modern day India, the world's most populous nation.
It'll be interesting to see what comes of that. So, Rob, finally, let's head to your neck of the woods in the UK, where this week Prince Harry will enter a courtroom in London and testify in a privacy case against some of Britain's newspapers. Also testifying, singer Elton John. What's happening here?
Yeah, so this is going to be a big case here in Britain. It started this morning, the last few hours. It's Prince Harry, who, as you know, normally resides in California, but he's over here again for his third major trial, in which he takes on Britain's tabloid press, tabloid newspapers, in this case for, quote, unlawful information gathering. And what he really means by that is that he will contend that over the course of his life, the tabloid press in Britain have really gone after him, trying to find every story in the book, and have done all sorts of nefarious things in order to try and find information on him. In fact, in 2023, so just a couple of years ago, he actually won a case against a big group in Britain called the Mirror Group Newspapers, in which he was able to show that they had used illegal tactics to try and get information on him. And now he's doing the same with another group of newspapers. But he's been joined by Elton John. He's been joined by, you know, the likes of Liz Hurley, all sorts of other kind of actors, actresses, celebrities, all of whom feel that their privacy has been infringed, and they want to take these papers to court and kind of bring them to heel. So it's going to be interesting to see this 9-week case that started today, that's bound to be kind of front page here in Britain over the coming weeks. So we'll be looking ahead to that.
Absolutely. All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. An intriguing thread on the Peoria, Arizona Neighbors Facebook page recently caught our eye here at the show. A woman named Gina Robertson had posted about her favorite server at a local Denny's. The server, Michael, had been her family's favorite for years. Whenever they went to the restaurant, which was often, they always asked to sit in his section. But the last time they went to Denny's, Michael was gone. No one seemed to know what had become of him. If you are a regular and know where he is working now, Gina wrote on Facebook, we'd love to know so that we can support him, no matter the restaurant. Gina's post prompted hundreds of replies, nearly all of them expressing shock and confusion. Michael, it turns out, has many diehard fans, all of whom are eager to know what happened. The outpouring of love was remarkable, though, according to Gina, not necessarily surprising. From her family's first visit to Denny's, she told me, there was something special about Michael.
He remembered our orders. By the time we sat down, he'd have our drinks there. One of my daughters has celiac, and he would always go the extra mile to make sure that she had something equitable that she could eat, even if it wasn't an option directly listed on that food item. He just always seemed to go the extra mile with a smile on his face, you know, always greeting us with fist bumps and happy. And I could see that in the entire section. The other section of the restaurant might be less full, whereas Michael's, there was always people coming in and out because they would request Michael. And we just continued to go to him for about 12 years.
On the Facebook post that you made, there are, as you know, hundreds of comments from other people who love Michael. One of them, Debbie, I hope I'm saying this last name correctly, Reisinger, she actually uploaded a video that she took of Michael back in 2014,
yes.
Dancing outside the restaurant. He's got his uniform on. He's got his apron around his waist. She has also added some music to the video, but you can hear a little of his voice and how the people around him are reacting. I thought we could listen to it together for just a moment.
You're missing all the action.
I know.
All the action.
Dang.
Like that?
Work it, work it, work it. Michael.
What do you hear in that?
I hear his joy. Mm-hmm. He just has that personality that brings life to those around him.
Did he ever dance for you?
No, he never danced.
Okay.
but I will tell you kind of a story that when we started going there, my oldest was probably about 10. And she went there one time when she was about 17 with a couple of guy friends, not boyfriends, but guy friends when she was in high school. And the two young men started acting a little inappropriately, not towards her, but just in general.
Okay.
And Michael went over and checked to make sure that she was okay.
Wow. That makes me think about the fact that when you have that kind of relationship with a server at a restaurant, which my family had a similar dynamic when I was a kid with a woman named Maria who used to work at this pizza restaurant, people like Michael and Maria sort of become a member of your extended family in this way?
Absolutely. Yes, because he saw my girls grow up. My girls are now almost 21 and almost 25, and everybody knew Michael and knew that we cared about Michael and Michael cared about us. And it was just a sense of we knew we could be ourselves with him.
How much did he share with you, if at all, about his own life? Did he ever talk to you about his life outside the restaurant?
Somewhat. He was definitely a Cardinals fan. Spoke about his mom a lot. Uh-huh. You know, he had a little salsa side business.
Oh, like salsa dancing?
No, like salsa.
Oh, okay.
Like the food salsa.
Really? I assume
yes.
I assume dancing because of the video clip of him dancing. But
yep.
That's really interesting. Did you ever try the salsa?
We did, and it was delicious.
Okay, all right. So let me ask you a little bit about this thread that you started and the life that
yes.
it's taken on.
I did not expect it at all.
What have you made of all of the hundreds and hundreds of comments that have come in from other people who knew and really seem to have a treasured relationship with Michael as you do?
Well, what I saw when I would read through the posts are two things. One is either somebody had also had Michael as a favorite server and were wanting to know where he was so that they as well could go support him wherever he was. Or there were those people that, you know what, I don't know who Michael is, but tell me where Michael is, because if this many people are talking about him, then he's obviously a wonderful server.
Yeah. And there's also at least one person on the thread, somebody named Mario, who is asking if anybody had found Michael because he wants Michael to come work at his restaurant.
Exactly. I saw that as well.
So the other thing that's important to note here, right, Gina, is that as of this recording, no one knows where exactly Michael has gone. He's not working at the Denny's anymore. And the main thing that's happening on this thread is people are trying to figure out what has become of him.
Yes. And right now it's at a standstill. I was told by a Denny's employee that he has gone to a Garcia's restaurant. I've called a couple of them. Nobody has heard of him. So at this point, I don't know where Michael is. I hope he's okay.
Can I ask you, one of the interesting little subtleties I thought of the thread of people who have been trying to track him down is at least a couple people seemed to have a phone number for Michael, and they had texted him. One of them said they had texted him a screenshot of this Facebook thread of all these people singing his praises.
Yes.
And none of them had heard back.
That's concerning. But of course, who knows what's going on in Michael's life? I would never want to intrude on his life. And because this is literally just a, you know, let's go find him and support him if he's a server at another restaurant. However, if he wants to be left alone, we can do that as well.
That was one of the things I was wondering, Gina. I wonder what you make of that. Do you think it's possible that having spent so much time sharing a version of himself with so many people, maybe he doesn't want to be found?
Exactly. And if that's his wish, then, you know, and if nobody ever finds him, then honestly, I just wish him the best in his life. Hope that the Cardinals can turn it around and be a winning team at some point.
Yes.
But, you know, I just want him to be happy.
So last question for you, Gina. This discussion, as we've been mentioning, is unfolding on the Peoria, Arizona Neighbors Facebook page. How would you compare this to other conversations and debates that happen there?
In our current political climate, there has been some very aggressive viewpoints.
Yeah.
So as I think that somebody mentioned it on the thread, this is the most wholesome post they've ever seen.
Yes.
On the website, on the Facebook group.
Another user wrote, quote, "My faith in humanity has been restored."
Absolutely. It's just given people a sense of goodness. If this thread, even if we aren't able to find Michael, brings a sort of peace to people, that's a wonderful side effect.
Well, Michael, if you hear this and you would like to reach out, we would love to talk to you. And I know that Gina and many others would be very happy to come sit in your section if you are still working as a server. But more than that, just to know that you're okay. But in the meantime,
we miss you, Michael.
In the meantime, I've been speaking with Gina Robertson, who started this thread on the Peoria, Arizona Neighbors Facebook page, which is ongoing as of this recording. Gina, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.